There was a study done in Australia. I used to work in palliative care as a doctor looking after dying people. In Australia, there was a palliative care nurse who wrote a book called The Top 5 Regrets of Dying People. These are people that were dying before their time, like I used to look after, of cancer or chronic neurological illness. You know what the top regret of dying people was? That they didn't have the courage to be themselves. And the third top regret was that they didn't have the courage to express their emotions. They pretended to be happy when they were not, and so on. So the question for the rest of us is, do we want to wait till some terminal illness wakes us up? Or should we just confront the fact that in so many ways we're afraid to be authentic because we're so afraid of being rejected? And as children, we didn't have much choice. As adults, can we develop that freedom to be ourselves? There's something about this culture that we live in that doesn't serve the health, but undermines the health of many of the people living in it. And you can look upon illness either as some random misfortune that hits people, very rarely dictated by genetics, but mostly just we don't know what causes it, and it's just bad luck, too bad. Or we can actually say, well, maybe there's something about the way we live that contributes to people's illness. And I'm saying that in this culture, illness is not an abnormality. It's actually a normal response to abnormal circumstances. One of the talks that I give is entitled The Myth of Normal, which is to say that we think that there are people who are normal over here, and then there's the pathological ones who have depression or anxiety or addiction or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or any number of other, ADHD or any number of other conditions. What I see is a continuum, that we're all on a continuum. These traits, to one degree or another, are present in almost everybody. And it's a mythology to think that there's the normal and then there's the abnormal. If I consciously know something, I'm totally aware of it, and I quite deliberately, for selfish reasons, go against what I know to be true, that's very rare. That's actually very rare. Now, unless there's also a difference between fault and responsibility. Yes, it's my responsibility how I lived my life. I did it. I mean, I did it out of certain patternings. It wasn't my fault. But who's going to respond to all that if I'm not me? Who's responsible if it's not me? So taking responsibility means that once I realize something, I do what I can to clean it up. That's how you take responsibility. But that's got nothing to do with fault. It's nothing to do with, not that I haven't blamed myself. Believe me, I have. You have to really learn not to blame yourself. But responsibility and blame are two different things. So disease is not an isolated phenomenon of an individual. It's a culture. It's a culturally manufactured or culturally constructed paradigm. So a society that cuts us off from our spirituality, that cuts us off from society by idealizing the individualism and by destroying social contexts, which our society does, which ignores our emotional needs, is going to be a society that generates pathology. And I think that has to do with the very nature of the economic system that says that what matters is not who you are, but how you are valued by others. And our society values people for material. It's a materialistic society, which specifically means that what we value is not who people are, but what they produce or what they consume. And the people that neither consume nor produce, they're ostracized, they're shunted aside, and they're totally devalued.
Well, let me tell you about a friend of mine who lives in Calgary. Her name is Shannon Duke. And Shannon is 48 years old now. And when she was 37, she was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. Now, stage 4 meant that the cancer was already in her bones by the time it was diagnosed. She had the perfect life, perfect marriage, perfect home, of course. And then she's diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. And she has a transformation. Now, she gets the best medical advice she can get anywhere in North America, and she traveled to New York and elsewhere. And she got the best medical treatment, and with that, she was given 1 year to live, because that's the prognosis. Stage 4, despite the medical treatment, chances are you'll be dead in 1 year. Now, a year ago, some of her friends celebrated her 10th year survival and her 47th birthday. And the transformation that she experienced was, When she was diagnosed and started paying attention, she realized that her life had not been her life, because she was sexually abused as a child. And her response to the abuse was, of course, as many children will experience, it can't be about the adults, it's about me. So if this terrible thing happened to me, I must be a very bad person. So I have to be very good to compensate. So the good daughter who doesn't talk about it, doesn't disturb the waters, the good employee, the good student, the good wife who doesn't talk about the husband's addiction issues. And when she's diagnosed and she decides she wants to live, she says, the hell with all this perfection and goodness. And she confronts her family of origin about the abuse that she had endured, and she confronts her husband, and she starts leaving an authentic, and she leaves the job, by the way, which wasn't her. Wasn't really expressing who she was. Now, 11 years later, the cancer is still in her bones, but it's completely inactive. But she knows that if she wants to stay alive, she needs to stay authentic. And one of the first books I read was Alice Miller and her book, The Drama of the Gifted Child. The original German subtitle of which was Prisoners of Childhood. And she was saying that fundamentally we're all prisoners of our childhood. In other words, the dynamics that were imprinted in us early on in life end up forming a cage or a prison from which we had to liberate ourselves. And that was very illuminating to me. And so then I gradually began to liberate myself. It's a real process, you know, and it's ongoing. I can't claim that I'm finished with it, and I don't think I ever will be, which is perfectly okay.
What happened to me is that I was born in Budapest, Hungary in 1944, to Jewish parents, just before the Germans occupied Hungary. And you know what happened to the Jewish people in Eastern Europe. And I was 2 months old when the German army moved into Budapest, the Wehrmacht, and the day after they did, my mother phoned the pediatrician and she said, would you please come and see Gabor, because he's crying all the time. And the pediatrician said, of course I will come to see him, but I should tell you, all my Jewish babies are crying. Now why? What do babies know about Hitler or genocide or war? Nothing. What we're picking up on is the stresses and the terrors and the depression of our mothers. And that actually shapes the child's brain. And of course, what happens then is I get the message that the world doesn't want me. Because if my mother's not happy around me, she must not want me. Why do I become a workaholic later? Because if they don't want me, at least they're going to need me. This interaction of environment and the individual begins already in the womb. And therefore, how we treat pregnant women has a huge impact on the long-term development of their yet unborn offspring. And this, of course, happens in doing infancy as well, because that's a crucial period of brain development. So that the infants of healthy mothers have very different cortisol stress hormone levels than those of mothers with postpartum depression. And if you look at the electroencephalograms of the infants of mothers who have postpartum depression, you can tell from the EEG of the child who is depressed and who isn't. So the child's electrical circuitry is already affected at 6 months of age by the mood of the mother. Now, in this society, 20% of women suffer postpartum depression, and another 20% have some symptoms of it. Now, that's not because of an individual problem with the part of the mother. Depression is not an individual issue. It reflects your relationship with the environment. And therefore, in this successful society, we're managing to depress 20% of women who give birth to babies. And that will have an effect on the child's brain hormone levels and neurotransmitter levels like dopamine and serotonin, and on the child's ability to respond to stress in a positive or in a highly charged and dysfunctional way. Children have no self-regulation. So if you're stressed as an adult, if you're mature enough, you can regulate yourself. You can take a few breaths. You can calm yourself down. You can say, okay, slow down. Let me think about this. Let me deal with this. An infant can't do that. Infant's got no self-regulation whatsoever. The infant's brain requires the mature function of the adult's brain to regulate it. But what if the adult's brain is not functioning maturely because that adult themselves never got the right conditions for the healthy development? Now you have an immature adult's brain regulating or trying to regulate an immature infant's brain. Well, that self-regulation never devolves. That's the dilemma for so many of us, is that as a result of childhood wounding,
We have to make ourselves into something that the world will accept and value. Like, look, in my case, I love having been a physician, and that's my calling. But the big part of it wasn't just that I wanted to help humanity or heal people. It's also I needed to be important. Now, why did I need to be important? Because as an infant, I got the message that I wasn't.
Yeah.
And so now then, and that creates a kind of an addiction, because you have to keep proving to yourself how important you are and how valuable you are. But nobody should have to prove how valuable they are. That's just our birthright, that we exist. We have the right to be here.
Your parents' emotional states start affecting you and your brain development in the womb. That's just the science.
And so as an adult kid, where do you begin? Well, you have to take responsibility for what's inside you. Not blame, but responsibility.
Yeah.
Not that I'm at fault for it. In fact, you're not at fault for it at all. But who's going to be responsible in the present moment to deal with that? Only you can do that. And the same with the adults. Same with the parents. And so that what we teach here is that it's not 50-50. It's 100%, 100%.
Yeah.
And I was talking to somebody today whose mother died before they had reconciled. But this person was still able to come to equanimity with her mother, who had really hurt her sometime after the mother's death. Because this person took on the internal task of healing themselves. So, you know, if both partners are around and they both want to work on it, it can be a very beautiful dance. But it does begin in both cases by willing to take responsibility for what we carry inside.
Yeah.
Not for how it got there.
Right.
But for what we're carrying.
Salient feature of the environment that shapes the circuits of the human brain is actually the relationship with the parents. And if the parents are present and emotionally attuned and available, the child brains develop properly. But the parents are stressed, the child absorbs the stress. What can they do with it? They tune out. And that tuning out thing is programmed into the brain. And then 10 years later or 50 years later, we say, you got this disease. No, you don't. You've got a coping mechanism that's no longer working for you, but it had a function when it first came along. So this whole idea, and by the way, if a family comes to me with their ADHD child, I'll say to them, what you've got here is a very sensitive child. That sensitive child is picking up on all the vibes, energies, and stresses in your family. Want to help this child? Deal with the whole family. Look at the parental relationship.
That human beings are biopsychosocial creatures. Biopsychosocial, which means that our biology is inseparable from our psychology, our emotions, and our thinking, and from our social relationships. Now that begins before birth. So already the emotional states of the mother during pregnancy are affecting the physiology and brain development of the fetus. So when mothers are stressed, fetuses are stressed. And when fetuses and embryos are stressed, even decades later, you can see the impacts of that stress in how they respond to stress as adults. So this process begins very, very early, and even in the womb. And this has been documented meticulously.
Genuine grief is the very opposite of trauma. If as children we could have grieved what was happening to us, really felt the sadness of not being loved, or the sadness of being hurt, grieved it, and grief comes in waves, and it recedes, and it comes in, and it goes out again, but it abates over time. If we would consciously have grieved, we would not have developed all these coping mechanisms that now keep us in trouble. So trauma actually is the resistance to grief, which incidentally, no child can be blamed for. It's just a natural reaction. So grieving, not in the sense of being hopelessly sad, that's different. Grieving is coming to terms with the loss. Yes, we've lost something. Yes, it's not going to be the same. Yes, life will go on. You know, so grief really is the antidote to trauma in that sense. Because grief is coming to terms with the reality.
Trauma is not what happens to you. It's what happens inside you. That's a good thing, by the way. Because if trauma... Here's what happened to me as a Jewish infant under the Nazis. If that was the trauma, I'll never be a person who wasn't a Jewish infant under the Nazis and during that period of genocide. If trauma is The fact that you were abused as a child?
If you're a small business owner, you already know what it takes to keep everything moving. You're juggling customers, invoices, and about 100 decisions every day. Thankfully, taxes don't have to be one more thing on that list. With Intuit TurboTax, you can get your business taxes done for you with a full-service expert. TurboTax matches you with your dedicated tax expert who knows your industry, understands your business write-offs, and gives you the personalized advice your business deserves. Upload your documents right in the app, hand everything off, and still feel like you're in the loop the whole way through. You can even get real-time updates on your expert's progress right in the app, which makes it so much easier to stay on track. And you can get unlimited expert help at no extra cost, even on nights and weekends during tax season. Visit TurboTax.com to get matched with an expert today. Only available with TurboTax Full Service Experts.
You will never be a person who wasn't abused as a child. Trauma can also be inflicted not by what happens to you, but what doesn't happen that should happen. So that when your needs aren't met, that can wound as well. Even though you weren't overtly hurt, you're still wounded by not having your essential human needs met. But if that was the trauma of what happened to you, guess what? It'll never unhappen. But if trauma is what happened inside you, the wound that you sustained, the meaning you made of it, the way you then came to believe certain things about yourself or the world or other people. And if trauma was that disconnection from the authentic self, well, guess what? Good news. That can be restored at any moment.
I was hurt so early. One of the adaptations you make emotionally when you're being hurt is you shut down your heart so you won't be so hurt. When you shut down your heart, it means that when you see somebody else suffer, you're not as open to them as you might be. So I was capable of being very harsh with my son, with all my children, not because I didn't love them, but because my heart wasn't as open as it needed to have been. And that shutdown of the heart was a protective device on my part as a small child.
Not like I'd had a peaceful life before. My life began in chaos. It began in the Second World War as a Jewish infant under the Nazi occupation. So chaos is all I knew. So that's where I learned to function. So I had nothing to compare it to now. What usually happens is the same thing that I understand happened to you. At some point, you get a big wake up. There's a Greek playwright, Aeschylus, who wrote 2,500 years ago in one of his plays that the ways the gods created us, we have to suffer into truth. So it's not like I had a big epiphany. Perhaps you did from one day to the next. I didn't. But I suffered in my life and my children suffered. And it doesn't matter how successful I was. And so I had to actually ask myself, what is the source of this? So it was a painful process, which continues to this day, of waking up to who I am not and who I really am. And the more I become who I am, the more peaceful life becomes for such strange reason. And the more satisfying it becomes, and the less anxiety there is, and so on. But it's a lifelong process.
I have a regular practice. If I meditate, do my yoga, if I pay attention to myself, I'm much less likely to sink back into old patterns. But for most of us, it's ongoing work, and it's a lifetime's work, and that's okay. That's what it means to be a human being. But I've done a lot of healing over the years in all kinds of ways, and I've worked with many others, helped their healing. So just look at yourself. How are you behaving? How are you showing up? What is the impact of how you speak and how you act on other people? What is the impact on yourself? What is driving that behavior? What are those patterns? Where did they come from? What can you do to change them? I think these are key questions that people who want to heal and be kind to themselves and to others need to ask themselves.
Seeking itself is a stance of deficiency because you're saying you haven't got something. In other words, you're not in touch with your own wholeness. So you're creating more problems for yourself by positing yourself as a seeker. That's one way to look at it. I'm not sure that's what they would say, but I've heard similar statements. Seeking, as long as it's in the service of truth, is great. If it's in the service of certainty, it can be a limitation. So people can use that truth seeking both to deepen their relationship to reality or to actually limit their relationship to reality. And I think it's a California-based Buddhist teacher, psychologist John Wellwood, who talks about what he calls a spiritual bypass. And I've seen a lot of people using a spiritual bypass to get away from themselves. So that the so-called spiritual seeing itself and the seeing of transcendent experience
and the self-definition as a spiritual seeker can be a way of avoiding contact with their truer selves, even though it's being done in the name of contact with the truer self.
There is an intelligence, and I'm not speaking about a operative creature up there or out there somewhere doing things and deciding things, but there's an intelligence in nature and creation that if we ignore, we create suffering for ourselves and other people. And aligning with that intelligence and aligning with that connection is really what, whether we do so consciously or whether we do so because we're called to do that in ways that manifest compassion and connection and love, that's the way we're meant to be. And so the recognizing that and the striving for it is what I call spirituality. The paths are many. Some find it through religion. Sometimes religion is an obstacle to that. In fact, often it is. But it may be a conduit to it as well, depending on who and how and where. It's what people are seeking. Many other paths that are not religious, but fundamentally, there's this spiritual nature that if we ignore, we're actually ignoring an essential part of ourselves.
If you look at the scientific literature on what triggers people's stress, it's uncertainty, conflict, and loss of control, which pretty much characterizes life under globalized capitalism for a lot of people around the world. So when you say we need to make an effort to reduce stress, what I'm actually arguing is that stress is a very function of the particular system that we're living under. So that, yes, we can do a lot individually to recognize stress and to reduce it and not to generate more stress for ourselves as best we can. That's entirely possible and even necessary. But then there's also these broader conditions. I mean, it's hard to tell advice. Like a Canadian health expert said, if you don't want to get sick, don't be poor. Don't get a house. Don't live near a railway line. Don't get a job in a toxic industry. And go on lots of vacations to sunny climes.
See, it never used to be that children grew up in a stressed nuclear family. That wasn't the normal basis for child development. The normal basis for child development has always been the clan, the tribe, the community, the neighborhood, the extended family. Essentially, post-industrial capitalism has completely destroyed those conditions. People no longer live in communities which are still connected to one another. People don't work where they live. They don't shop where they live. The kids don't go to school necessarily where they live. The parents are away most of the day. For the first time in history, children are not spending most of their time around the nurturing adults in their lives. And they're spending their lives away from the nurturing adults, which is what they need for healthy brain development.
It was an article about Brazil. And the article was about a man called Nigio Gomes, a leader of the Guarani people in the Amazon, who was killed last November. And you probably heard about him. And he was killed because he was protecting his people from the big farmers and companies that are taking over the rainforest and destroying the rainforest and they're destroying the habitat of the native Indian people here in Brazil. And I can tell you that coming from Canada, the same thing has happened over there. And many of my patients were actually First Nations Indian people, Native Indian people in Canada. And they are heavily addicted. They make up a small percentage of the population, but they make up a large percentage of the people in jail, the people who are addicted, the people who are mentally ill, the people who commit suicide. Why? Because the lands were taken away from them and because they were killed and abused for generations, generations, and generations. But the question I ask is, if you can understand the suffering of these native people and how that suffering makes them seek relief from pain in their addictions, what about the people who are perpetrating it? What are they addicted to? Well, they're addicted to power. They're addicted to wealth. And when I was trying to understand the addiction to power, I looked at some of the most powerful people in history. I looked at Alexander the Great. I looked at Napoleon. It's very interesting when you look at these people. First of all, why did they need power so much? Interestingly enough, physically, they were all very small people. They came from outsiders. They were not part of the major population. Stalin was a Georgian, not a Russian. Napoleon was a Corsican, not a Frenchman. Alexander was a Macedonian, not a Greek. And Hitler was an Austrian, not a German. So a real sense of insecurity and inferiority. And they needed power to feel okay in themselves, to make themselves bigger. And in order to get that power, they're quite willing to fight wars and to kill a lot of people just to maintain that power. The addiction to power is always about the emptiness that you try and fill from the outside.
when you compare it to people like the Buddha or Jesus. Because if you look at the story about Jesus and Buddha, both of them were tempted by the devil. And one of the things that the devil offers them is power, earthly power. And they both say no. Now, why do they say no? They say no because they have the power inside of themselves. They don't need it from the outside.
As an adult, if I were to intrude on your space in a hostile or threatening way, at some point, you'd want to get angry with me. My space, get out. That's healthy anger. So healthy anger is a boundary defense. It just keeps you from being invaded and being intruded upon. We have a circuit in our brain for anger. Anger is not the bad thing. All animals have a circuitry. All mammals have anger circuitry in their brain. Why? Because it helps them defend their territories. You're in my space, get out. It's healthy. In fact, it prevents conflict. Because if I mount a big anger display, we might not come to blows. So anger is a boundary defense, right?
It's no longer a question of how do we try and get the other person to change, but how do we learn together to be in the present rather than coming from the past. And that's beautiful work. So that relationships, they can be hell, but they can also be the pathway out of hell if there's sufficient willingness and mutual support to do so.
The more sensitive you are by nature, genetically, the more hurt you're going to be. Some of the worst criminals are the most sensitive people in the world. And by sensitive, I don't mean that they are aware and care for the feelings of others. I mean that they were born so sensitive that they were hurt much more easily than others. They felt more. When they were hurt, they felt more. The more they felt, the more pain they felt, the more they had to shut down. The more they shut down, the less compassionate and the more cruel they became. Once those of them that can work through their pain and their trauma actually become very sweet and loving people. And I've seen this repeatedly, and so have many others.
Sensitivity is simply a trait that people tend to be born with. It's probably significantly genetically determined. And the more sensitive you are, the word sensitivity itself comes from the Latin word for feeling. The sensere means to feel. So the more sensitive you are, the more you feel. Now, the more you feel, of course, the more you absorb and sense and get in tune with the environment, which is what artists do. Poets, artists, actors, creators of, you know, sculptors, actors, you know, dancers. It's just like they have these antenna out that just pull in energies, you know, which really promotes what you call the superpower of creativity. But that same sensitivity also makes them more susceptible to pain. Loneliness is obvious perception. There's a difference between being alone and being lonely. Alone is just a fact and that we can embrace and make decisions about. Loneliness has got an emotional charge to it, and that's very much a matter of perception. You can be alone and not be lonely, and you can be surrounded by all kinds of people and be completely lonely. So that depends, how open am I? How vulnerable am I really willing to be? What defenses have I erected around myself to protect myself that keeps me from really contacting other people? But I think we unwittingly generate loneliness. There's also something else that happens, and you referred to this earlier. You talked about elders. So in our society, we don't talk about elders. We talk about the elderly. It's not the same. In our society that defines people so much in terms of their economic value, we tend to discard people that are not perceived as having economic value either as producers or consumers. But this society generates a lot of loneliness just because of its materialistic values.
The addiction wasn't your problem. Your addiction was your attempt to solve the problem. And the real question is, how did that problem develop? How come it's 7 billion human beings in the world, you felt lonely? How come you lacked a sense of agency, control, authority in your life? Why are we in so much emotional pain? And everything you said, the loneliness, the lack of power, the lack of control, the anxiety, these are forms of emotional pain. So my mantra on addiction is not why the addiction, but why the pain.
Of course, in today's economy, there are two reasons why people work hard. One is that economically, they have to work longer hours or hold on to jobs just to make it. That leads to addiction because when people are stressed, they're more likely to become addicted. So, for example, the consumption of junk foods has gone up in North America since the economic crisis because the fats and the sugars in the junk foods actually release endorphins in the brain, which are the brain's opiates. So by stressing people, we're making them more likely to be addicted. And secondly,
as the New York Times has reported in a number of articles, were stressing families so children have less time with their parents, which interferes with their particular brain development, which makes them more prone for addiction as well.
Now, at the heart of all addictions, there's tremendous shame. The addicted individual or individuals, whether they admit it or not, are really ashamed of themselves. So shame shows up in all kinds of ways, and it's a barrier to self-knowledge, because when we're ashamed, we're inclined to protect and to hide. And it's not helpful. In either direction, it's not helpful. We have this expression in English that says you should be ashamed of yourself. Well, examine that for a moment. Nobody should be ashamed of one's self. And there's a distinction between being ashamed of what you do and what you've done and who you are and what you are.